I'm Rick Gamley. This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For years, there's been a lot of lamenting about youth athletics and how they've become way too intense. Books like Why Johnny Hates Sports and Just Let the Kids Play charge that adults have, in some cases, ruined it for children. Many worry about what they call a toxic sports environment, a culture of too much, too soon, too hard, too young. They point to increasing injuries among young athletes, concerns over frantic schedules and lack of family time, and a high percentage of kids quitting sports because it's just not fun. But there's also a pushback movement developing. Parents, coaches, and kids were calling for a timeout where everyone can take a deep breath, pull back, stop focusing on winning above all, and refocus on the joy of play. Today in The Exchange, have kids' sports become too intense? Do you see youth athletics going overboard in terms of the demands on time or on kids' bodies? Or do you think most families and teams still have a balanced philosophy and the right approach? Also, given childhood obesity, is it possible that sports aren't intense enough, that kids need more sports in their lives? Let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from New York City is Luis Fernando Llosa. He's an investigative reporter, including for Sports Illustrated, and co-author of Beyond Winning, Smart Parenting in a Toxic Sports Environment. He's also co-founder of the group Whole Child Sports, an organization that offers resources to help raise young athletes. Luis, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Also with us in studio, Pat Corbin, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Interscholastic Athletic Association. Pat Corbin, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
And also with us, Heather Barber, Associate Professor of Sports Psychology at UNH. She's worked as a sports psychology consultant for girls' soccer within the Olympic Development Program. And Heather, good to see you too. Thank you for your time.
It's great to be here.
Well, all of you, but Heather, you first. As I said, you know, people have been talking about this and writing about it for a long time, at least the past two decades. What's the feeling, Heather, that's driving all this concern? What are people seeing on the soccer fields and hockey rinks of America that worries them?
Well, I think first we have to start with the premise that I think sport has the potential to be a great thing. And that's one of the things that's wonderful for youth sport. So I don't want to start off on the far side of that. But I do think at this point in time in youth sport, there is an overemphasis, especially early on in specialization. And we find kids, and that's where a lot of the intensity comes, is children typically aren't playing multiple sports now. They're starting earlier and earlier at a specialized sport and staying within that sport. So it increases the potential of injury. It increases the likelihood of greater pressure and expectations. It increases the likelihood of overspending. So a whole variety of things come in that may increase the intensity there.
So that's one trend that people see. You know, John or Jane used to play baseball in the spring and, you know, soccer in the fall, basketball in the winter.
Now it's summer.
Yeah. And now it's all one sport all the time.
And now it tends to be that, you know, you're playing one sport, so it may be that you're playing on a club team, you're playing on a school team, you're playing on your town team, but it's all one sport rather than multiple sports across seasons.
And the club teams are the private organizations that can be expensive and require a lot of travel.
Yes, and provide a lot of commitment in terms of the financial commitment, but also club coaches tend to say, make a choice. I want you, so that it limits a lot of their opportunities in other directions.
What are people seeing, Luis? I'd love to hear from you. And by the way, you've got five kids, so you're living this not only professionally, but also personally. What are people seeing out there on the field and not liking?
Well, I think what they're seeing is too much intensity of feeling of competition from the parents, and it's rooted in I think a deep psychological wish. Interesting, it's a positive thing. Parents want their kids to do well, to develop self-confidence, and to succeed. And that's the basis for this, the foundation for this. But the way they go about it, psychologically, they end up turning 3 out of 4 kids quit youth sports by the age of 13. It may be up to 80% by the age of 15, according to some statistics. And I'll give you two examples of this that I've seen firsthand. The first is a girl who I was coaching on a team, and I met her for the first time on a day when I was meeting all the players. And she came up to me bouncing up and down and said, Coach, I want to be goalkeeper. Her dad was standing right behind her, and in a loud voice that everybody around us heard, including all her future teammates, he said, she has horrible hands.
He said that in
front of everybody? By which he meant, of course, you know, she can't catch, she's a terrible person for you to put in goal, it's going to ruin your season. All of that was implied in that one phrase.
Wow.
The girl was crestfallen. Now, as a coach, having seen this, I obviously had only one thing I could do, which is put her in goal that day. And I put her in goal every week for a quarter, because the games were divided into quarters, for the rest of the season. And by the middle of the season, something incredible happened. She got good hands, and she was saving things and diving. And at the end of the season, her dad said, wow, you know, she's really developed. But the point here is, when you're a parent, you have to be a little more sensitive. You have to be a little more mindful and self-aware. Those kinds of statements can make a kid want to quit altogether. And if there isn't another adult who's a little more self-aware, in this case, I guess I'm the hero, I don't mean to be. But as a coach, I understood what she was going through.
So parents want the best for their kids, Luis. They want them to get the exercise and the fun and the training, but they go overboard.
Yes, and here's the one other short example. Picture me and my 8-year-old son, and we're walking on a golf course. It's the sun is going down. It's a beautiful evening, and we come across a man and his 1.5-year-old child, and the little boy is putting. Because there's nobody around, you know, they live off the golf course. They're probably not members, but they go and have a little putting fun. I look at the man. I don't know him. I kind of nod, saying hello, and I start walking around his son. And he looks at me, and his son has just missed a putt. Again, 1.5 years old. He looks at me, and he says, my son is a terrible putter, by way of apology, because his son just missed a putt. I was that was one of the moments that crystallized for me.
Oh, he's a toddler.
How off we are,
right,
in our thinking.
Well, how about you, Pat Corbin? You've been in this business for a long time. What are you seeing that is causing all this angst?
I guess from my perspective, and it's really been accelerated in the last even 8 years that I've been at the NHIA. And that's just the attitude of parents and student athletes, to a certain extent, but more parents, of entitlement. Everybody seems to be entitled to a professional career, or think they're going to be there. Money, I think, plays a great part in it. You get parents who are investing tens of thousands of dollars in these private club programs, and after you do that for 5 or 6 years, now you're invested. So you have to hope that their promises of D1 scholarships and professional careers are going to come true. The statistics don't bear that out in any way, shape, or manner, particularly if you're from a small state like New Hampshire. And that's not to denigrate our student athletes. Our single biggest problem as a state association, and I think I could say as a high school principal prior to this time, is parents. Uncategorically, parents are the problem. And although not all parents are bad, and not all parents are out of control, if you will, the numbers are just very, very much skewed and much different than they used to be.
So the parents are pushing too hard, too fast, too young, as Luis's book puts it.
There's no question. I mean, our young people today can't go out without having a real official, without having an announcer and a scorekeeper and everything that mimics or looks like a professional or a college game. They can't go out and play ball anymore like we did when I was a kid. You'd go out and have a great time. The whole notion of fun is no longer stressed or part of the equation, and that's what we've really lost, and that's what is, I think, going to kill high school athletics. I think high school athletics are at a point where there are people out there trying to push this to a model similar to the European model, where the competitive programs are the club programs and the school programs are basically intramural.
And anybody can play, and it's all fun and so forth. Right.
Which, I mean, there's some value to that, but I think we've lost the whole notion of there's some pride in playing for your school. There's some pride in wanting to win and to do that and keep that in perspective. And we really have lost that.
Wow, lots to talk about, folks. Let me invite our listeners also to join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. Give us a call. Tell us what you think. Have youth athletics gone overboard in terms of the demands on time and in terms of the intensity? Or are most people still achieving that right balance? We're only talking about a small slice of the population here. Also, given concerns on the other side about childhood obesity, is it possible there aren't enough sports? If sports aren't intense enough, let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And all of you want to hear from you on this next question. But Heather, to you first, please. So square what we're talking about, the four of us, about, you know, the intensity, the frequency, all the time, with childhood obesity. I mean, on the other hand, we've got kids who are said to be, you know, sitting in front of computers or, you know, their phones all day, and they're not moving enough.
Well, I think Luis's numbers were absolutely indicative of what the issue is. If kids are dropping out of sport by the time they're 13 or by the time they're 15, and that's 80% of them, that starts at an earlier age. And so oftentimes then sport kind of sets up a dynamic of, well, physical activity isn't my thing, not just that sports aren't my thing, and being physically active doesn't become a part of their daily habits. And so I think that becomes a part of the process is, if I'm not good at sport, well, then I don't want to even be physically active. And there's lots of levels of sports that kids can be involved in. And I think that's an important part of the physical activity part, that we keep kids physically active over a long period of time.
All right. Well, I'll hear from you, Pat, and you, Luis, after a break, and we'll take your calls as well. 1-800-892-6477. Coming up in just a moment, more on kids' athletics, whether they've become too intense or not intense enough. 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. An HPR special series on higher education in the state, A Matter of Degrees, tackled a broad range of topics. Last week, we spoke to students about their experience, looked at schools focused on STEM, how students can best prepare for college, and much more. You can find all of our stories as well as our web-only content at nhpr.org. The series was made possible with support from the Dairy Field School and Edvest and you. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Rotary, providing community service to Vermont, New Hampshire, and the world. Rotary, humanity in motion, rotary7870.org. From Sovereignet Communications, a locally operated telecom provider, building an 850-mile fiber network to connect communities, schools, and businesses. And the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association, presenting its third annual Restaurant Week, May 16th through the 23rd. Participating restaurants at restaurantweeknh.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, have youth sports become too intense? Give us a call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests for the hour, Luis Fernando Llosa, investigative reporter, co-author of Beyond Winning, Smart Parenting in a Toxic Sports Environment, co-founder of Whole Child Sports, also Pat Corbin, executive director of the New Hampshire Interscholastic Athletic Association, and Heather Barber, associate professor of sports psychology at UNH. And Pat and Luis, to you as well, if I could please, Luis, square this intensity trend that we're talking about with the other side, which is kids not moving enough.
Yeah, and you know, I think that Pat said it well. There, one of the problems, one of the biggest problems we have, Heather said it as well, is that kids are quitting early, and then they feel like they're I'm not an athlete, and so they stop playing. So the heart of the corrective potential is in finding out why kids are quitting so early and changing that. And that's a lot easier said than done. But we have to work with this attrition rate. And what is important is to create a sports setting that's not a pressure cooker. And again, we spoke earlier about the pressure coming down from the parents and making it more fun. But there's another element. Sports are too adult-directed, and Pat alluded to this. They're too, the youth sports has been, there's been an adultification. Everything is like what you see in the pros. The games are structured mostly the way they're played in the pros. Most kids play with 10-foot hoops, even when they're younger. They shouldn't. Most kids until recently, with a lot of the clubs that have changed this, were playing, even when they were 7, 8, and 9, in massive goals that are played you know, full fields. That doesn't work. So more and more, this is happening. There's a change going on. But it has been the adults who say, no, this is tradition. We can't change the rules of football so that there's no tackling on a punt return. There's no rushing a punt return player. I have one of my partners, Scott Lancaster, was almost drummed out of youth football, even though he was the head of the NFL's youth player development program and one of the most well-respected football consultants for youth in the country in his own town, because he was trying to change and modify some rules to make the game more safe for kids. There's this big pushback about tradition. There's another issue which we should probably talk about a bit later, which is the issue of creativity, which is really important as well.
All right. So, Pat, you on this topic, why kids are quitting so early, why we have these dual trends of sports intensity and kids not doing enough sport or just active play.
Well, I mean, if you talk to college coaches repeatedly, they don't want to see a student that's played one sport for the last 10 years, because it's more than likely that student, if he or she hasn't already burned out, they're probably going to it at some point in time. They tell us they're looking for good, solid, athletic performers, someone who has played three sports, someone who understands that and not specialized. We have a lot of three-sport athletes still. Unfortunately, they play in the high school basketball team, then they go play in a club team that night afterwards, and then at midnight they're playing junior ice hockey, for example. So they're playing three sports a day, but not to their best interest.
Yeah.
And I have watching my own grandchildren and having seen this trend evolving over the last few years, I have a little different read on the obesity issue. I think they're getting plenty of exercise. The issue is that if you're playing three sports a night or two sports a day, or you're running, your parents are taking you over to, 20 miles away to play a game after you get done your practice at school, and people never sit down and have a decent meal or talk about nutrition or do things that are wholesome in terms of wellness.
You're grabbing a meal at McDonald's.
They grab the meal at McDonald's. So
with the sugary drink.
No matter how much you work out, the eating habits have changed. And we're involved in a 10-year program right now, a substantial grant that deals with, among other things, wellness, drugs and alcohol, of course, but diet and how do you manage that? The other way we're trying to address some of these issues is to demystify what's an athlete. You don't have to play football or basketball to be an athlete. We've added sports in the last 3 or 4 years, like bass fishing, like bowling, sports that appeal to our strategic goal is to get sports or activities that appeal to a far wider variety of students than the normal traditionally perceived basketball player, soccer player, football player.
Speaking of someone who can't do anything with a ball, I appreciate that. So,
well, it's been very well received, to be honest with you.
Lots of audience feedback, so let's go to them, folks. Again, the number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Here's an email from Rob. He says, this must be very confusing for the kids. At the younger ages, all we hear about is how we've ruined youth sports by our attitude of everyone gets a trophy, no one loses. Then when they get to junior high and high school, we put all kinds of pressure on them to be the best so they can get a scholarship. Rob, it's a terrific point. Luis, what do you think? That's another trend that we hear at the younger ages. You know, scoreless soccer, scoreless basketball. I've been at these games myself. Everybody's keeping score, but it's just not official.
Yes, you know, that's a great point. I mean, as human beings and as parents who are always competitive and concerned about, you know, my child first, we're going to figure out a way to make something hyper-competitive, even if we have these, you know, superimposed league-mandated rules not to score. It's really interesting to me that in youth sports, in every sport, in martial arts, pretty much across the board, probably in bowling too, we have these national championships at the age of 7, 9, 11, as if your child winning a national championship, and by the way, as a footnote, there are probably like 70 or 700 national championships in every sport, because any league or any club can develop a structure of a national championship. You just have to set it up and then charge families thousands of dollars to travel to tournaments to create these national championships. But the problem is, in truth, if your child wins a national championship in basketball at the age of 10 and 11, but quits the sport at the age of 13 because he's got a torn ACL, which is irreparable, fully torn, and then he's out, and he's never going to have the experience of healthy play again. So we really need to change our thinking. It doesn't have to be everybody wins a trophy. It should be a focus on all these younger kids having fun, and that's easy to say, but there are ways to set up drills and teach them in a way that can still be fun and yet has them learning. Because kids will walk off the field having learned a new move or seen that they've gotten better at something, which with a great sense of satisfaction. And it doesn't have to be that they won 5-0 against another team or that it was scoreless soccer, but they did well. It's a question of, are they having fun and are they learning? And most of the time, if you leave kids alone, they have a great time. Introduce adults who are managing and controlling everything and directing everything, and there is quite a high possibility that things will get a lot messier.
All right.
So one of the things we need to be able to structure is adult supervised play, which is in the ages between, you know, 7, 6, 7, and 9, 10, 11, which is not hyper organized and command oriented. We've been shooting a documentary on this, and in a trip to North Carolina, we interviewed Jenny Levy, the coach for the women's lacrosse for the University of North Carolina. She just won the national championship this year, actually. And interesting, because this ties in with specialization as well, which Pat was just mentioning. She told me that the recruits she gets, which are the best in the world at lacrosse, because she's one of the top 5 programs in the nation, are like overbred dogs when they come to her. They've played way too much of only lacrosse. They've been barked at and told what to do by coaches from the age of 5.
Yikes.
They have no creativity. They don't know what to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember, I think it might have been you, Pat, actually, told me a while back that sometimes the pro baseball teams feel like the Dominican players, who haven't been as heavily managed as American kids, actually have more creativity because they haven't been sort of hounded at every moment. I want to ask you a very quick question, Heather, and
sure,
then we do need to go to our callers. Rob, our emailer, talks about, again, you know, scoreless soccer, everybody gets a trophy, and then it switches by the time middle school comes around. What about the idea, though, of competition? I mean, you know, some parents have a real problem with scoreless soccer and scoreless basketball. I mean, life isn't scoreless. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose, and you need to learn how to deal with that.
Absolutely. I mean, winning and losing is a part of sport. But remember, I think it's critical to understand that 50%, by the fact that it is competition, 50% of people lose. And if we think sport is such a great thing, we have to be playing for more than just winning and losing. It has to be fun. They have to be learning. They have to be making friends. They have to be developing skills that are going to allow them to be physical activity participants for a lifetime in terms of that part of it. And I think we get so focused on outcome. And I think there are times when we can de-emphasize outcome or, like Louise talked about, restructure games so you're playing for different things, that maybe you keep score on the number of every time you pass the ball three times consecutively, you get a point. Or, you know, we can change the game to refocus the game on different ways of developing skills, still make it fun, still create a competitive environment, but that focuses on different aspects of the game.
All right, let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Jane's waiting in Swansea. Hi, Jane. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. So I have a unique perspective as a high school teacher and as a parent. As a high school teacher for the last 20 years, you know, without a doubt, my students who are competitive athletes are they're more organized, they're more focused, they're better team players, you know, in the classroom. So I've always seen it as a really, you know, good thing. Then we have our own children, and, you know, particularly my son, who's 10 now, we started him off, you know, just playing soccer, rec soccer, 4 or 5 years old. You know, he was a kid with a lot of energy. You know, everybody, you know, he gets older, people are saying, oh, he's really good, he's really good, you should put him on a travel team. We hesitated, and then we finally put him in this travel club, and it was a complete disaster from the coaches to the parents to the other kids. The attitude was completely focused on winning. He hated it. We had to pull him out, and now we're trying to find other sports that he can do. We're trying rock climbing, we're trying things like, but the whole travel culture was ridiculous.
Ridiculous in terms of how much time or how much money, Jane, or just the attitude?
The money was a lot, but it wasn't that. It was the time. We were expected to give up our weekends, but also the parents were so competitive, screaming at their kids, and the coach, you know, right there with them, the other kids on the team getting mad at kids who, you know, weren't really, really good, and maybe they let a goal in or they missed a goal, you know, not playing all the kids equally. You know, it's supposed to be, you know, they're 9 and 10. Right. It was a really bad experience. And I felt bad because my son said, well, maybe I'll just go back to soccer when I get into 7th grade where they have it in the school. But guess what? He's not going to be good enough to make that team because he hasn't been playing travel soccer the whole time.
Yeah. You know, Jane, that is an issue. What do you think, Pat? There's a lot to untangle here, including the rise of these expensive travel teams that some kids love, but they are quite demanding.
Yes, they are demanding, and in my mind, that's the big thing that's missing with these club and private programs. We always talk about student athletes, and we're very, very committed to the fact that every student athlete playing for the NHIA is a student first and athlete second, and that's the message I think that school-based athletics can stress and keep a focus on, that sometimes clubs, or oftentimes clubs, don't have that advantage, or they don't really care or understand the relationship. As the former caller said, yes, these young people, they're our busiest athletes. When we do our Scholar Athlete Award, I ask how many have jobs, 99% stand up. How many are involved in other clubs, 99% of them. How many are involved in volunteer projects in the community, 99% of them.
They're well-rounded
as long as it's kept in perspective, and as long as they put academics and first and use the athletics as an incentive to improve that. Because if you talk to a Matt Bonner, probably the only NBA player to come out of the state of New Hampshire, Matt will tell kids, and he'll tell you, and he's told me many times, when I meet with young people, I tell them, if you want to go to college, you want to be successful, study. I mean, he was the valedictorian in his class, so he understands the importance of a good education. But most people will tell you, if you're going to get a scholarship, it's not going to be through athletics. So.
And real quick to you, Pat, we talked about this earlier with Luis and Heather. What do you think about Rob's email about, scoreless basketball, scoreless soccer at the younger ages?
I don't know. I have mixed feelings. I don't necessarily agree with that. Now, to give a very, very quick example that's kind of contrary to that, we instituted unified sports in New Hampshire, which takes socially or intellectually impaired or disabled youngsters, mixes them with regular education students, and they play teams. We're the only state in the country, and we insisted, and I had this with the executive director of the Special Olympics Association, we agreed up front that we were going to make this look as much, these teams look as much like regular high school teams as we possibly could. And everybody said, well, that's absurd. That's not right. That's not fair. You're going to, you know, it's ironic that you who fight against this with the other clubs are saying, here, we're going to take a bunch of special education youngsters and put them into a competitive experience. But our feeling is that at 21, the notion that everybody gets an award goes away for these kids when they age out of school. And what we've seen is just a tremendous growth in ability. And you know, from the first year when the officials wanted to just kick the ball back in to now the kids line up. If you were to watch a unified basketball game, the start of it, you'd think it was a JV high school game. So they have raised, we've raised the bar and kept it in perspective. Everybody loves to play. Everybody enjoys it. So it can be done.
Well, again, Jane, thank you for that call. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Now, here's an interesting email that came in from Mackenzie. And Louise, I'll throw this to you. She says, this is a bigger problem than just parents and schools. As a society, we worship the professional athlete. At the same time, we cut funding in schools for PE, physical education, and take away recess. Mackenzie says parents are forced into club programs and the fun is lost. This is a really interesting point. What do you think, Louise?
I think she's absolutely right. First of all, the societal problem is that we put professional athletics and athletes on a pedestal and we all want to be like them. And the problem I had in my reporting at Sports Illustrated, this came up all the time. Any story that involved the youth involved this skewed, collective psyche. The first story I ever did that was investigative was about a kid named Danny Almonte, who was from the Dominican Republic, a very good athlete, but nothing spectacular. He was from the Bronx, living in the Bronx, having been shipped up by his dad so he could play Little League. And his dad colluded with his coach to fake his age. So the kid was 14 pitching against 12-year-olds, which is like a 12-year-old facing a 100-mile-an-hour fastball when you're facing somebody that much older in physical development. And Danny Almonte became a sensation. Best pitcher in the last 40 years. He pitched a perfect game. He was on the cover of USA Today. He was on the, he was in Time Magazine, all over the place. Meanwhile, his team was given the key to the city by Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. Meanwhile, I was in the Dominican Republic investigating the age of Sammy Sosa and Pedro Martinez. And
Luis, I'm going to have you finish that story up in just a moment. I apologize for jumping in on you there. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. Good morning. It's 9:39.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, an update on efforts to hold bankers criminally responsible for the 2008 financial crisis, and then Highwire artist Philippe Petit on why he thinks breaking the rules leads to creativity. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners. Sam from Dartmouth-Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. And Beans and Greens Farm in Guilford, harvesting fresh greens daily, also featuring the farm bakery with pies, cookies, and breads. On Facebook and at beansandgreensfarm.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the question of whether youth sports have become too intense. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or find us on Twitter at nhprexchange. And Louise, just before the break, you were following up on Mackenzie's email who said, hey, this is a bigger societal problem. We worship professional athletes. At the same time, we cut funding for gym. We take away recess. And you were finishing up that point. Go ahead, Louise.
Yes. And I mean, obviously, the issue of funding youth sports and gym, it's vital and it has to be worked through at at a municipal and governmental and educational level. But the issue of supporting and paying homage to and sort of deifying professional athletics and then forcing our kids to mimic them in how they're trained, how much they're trained, how much we seek scholastic scholarships. Interestingly enough, Pat mentioned this earlier, the numbers are quite ironic and almost to the point of hilarity. Fewer than 2% of high school athletes will become Division I athletes with a scholarship. And that scholarship averages $11,000 a year. But parents, even parents who don't have the means through second mortgages and home equity lines of credit, are paying over the course of the years of their child's development from the age of 5 to the age of 12 or 13, tens of thousands, sometimes $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, chasing that dream of their kid getting a scholarship.
Really?
It makes no
wow.
sense. The numbers don't make any sense.
That's a lot of cash, Luis.
Yes, I know. And to finish the point about Danny Almonte, his father and his coach on this travel, high-profile travel team manipulated him into lying to the entire country about his age. And it ruined the kid for the rest of his life. And the other cases that I've seen have to do with steroids. Parents have come up to me even, just before I was doing a show on Chris Benoit, the wrestler who killed his wife and son because he was hopped up on testosterone and a bunch of other drugs, in a CNN waiting room, somebody who was doing makeup on me said, my husband wants our son who plays baseball to use growth hormone to grow so he can play be better at baseball because he's a first baseman and he needs to be taller so he can reach the ball. That's the kind of thinking that I was hearing all across the country as I traveled. One kid who I reported on, an inline skater, and most people don't even know what that sport is. You run around, you skate around in an oval as fast as you can is basically, in a nutshell, what the sport is. He started injecting his son with testosterone and human growth hormone at the age of 11.
People are doing that to their kids. You know, Heather, this is very – I want to go back to our listeners because we've got lots of calls and emails. But, Heather, this is really dangerous for young bodies especially. I mean, anybody, but especially the developing body.
Well, and I think that's a critical part is the kind of setting up the professional model for young children. You know, young children aren't professional athletes. They haven't been trained in those things, nor are they cognitively, emotionally, or physically ready to have that kind of training. I do think that some of this comes down to, one, we can train parents better to be better parents, and coaches can do that. But I also think we can train our coaches better so that they're giving parents better information on how to help their children, too.
All right, let's go to our listeners again. And Denise is waiting in Bridgewater. Hi, Denise. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi. I'm a victim of that. My son is a ski racer, and that's his sport, and that's what he chose to do. So we ended up going to an academy for that, and it's all about that. But I thought I would offer the opinion that it is so positive for us, and our son is so into it, and he's so thankful and grateful that he had the opportunity to be able to do it. And, you know, with all the Division I colleges and all the scholarships and all that Olympic dreams and all the things that they all want, in the end, the thing that he's going to take out of this, if we stop right now, is the memories, he works better at school. He breathes the fresh air. He gets all that in his lungs. And it's not for everybody, but in his heart, and that's the communication between the parent and the child, because if he didn't want to do it, there's no way I would invest any kind of money into it. And I always remind him, are you sure you want to still do this? And he's like, yes. And, you know, it has to be a happy experience, but, you know, it's not for everyone. Some kids aren't as intense, and my son is, and he's meeting people friends that'll last a lifetime, and the work ethic that they have, and motivated to do more schoolwork because he's active as well. And the point that they had mentioned with the public schools not having enough recess, I had experienced that as well with 15 minutes of recess and, you know, hardly any phys ed classes. And These kids need oxygen in their lungs to
Get, by the time they get out there and plan a game, recess is
right,
over.
Right.
Denise, can I ask you a quick question, please? You said he's a ski racer. It's great. It's all about that. Now, what do you mean? Does that, like, does it suck up your weekends? Does, if you have other children, do they kind of get sucked into that? Or
nope. It's, I have one child, and he just absolutely, if it was summer and down in Chile, that's what he wants to. He wants
Well, so it is positive. Yeah, and you know, Pat, let's not forget that. I mean, there's a lot of problems, but let's not forget that sports can be extremely positive for kids.
Yeah, I mean, that was on my note to mention. I think we can talk about the trends, and it is a frightening and disheartening trend that we all parents and people should be very concerned about. But that being said, I've also worked with many very talented and good coaches who really are the role model we want them to be. And I can tell you as a principal, when you had school vacation and people came back to visit the school from college, from whatever they were, I would say 9 out of 10 would come into the office and say, is coach here? Because there is a very, very special bond, and if it's done properly, and it's not always done properly, but there is, for a good coach, they're building character and skills and life skills that transcend skiing or any specific sport. And those people are still out there, although, quite frankly, they're becoming harder to find, unfortunately.
Well, and that's true. And my kids have had some terrific, terrific coaches. Thank you so much for that call. Tons of emails, too, that I'd love to share with you. I'll give this to you, Heather. This person didn't give a name. They say, organized sports are fine for those who have the money and support to participate, but many kids are left out. And are they enough for overall fitness? This person says, I feel fortunate that when I was a kid, we got our exercise riding bikes, swimming, sliding on the hills, playing softball, touch football, backyard basketball. It was free. We could play when we wanted, when we wanted. For a number of reasons, kids don't seem to have that anymore. But I'd like to see more places where kids could simply play with their friends. This is a great point, Heather, and I wonder what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the value of play throughout our lifetime is a really critical part. And it being self-initiated becomes an important part if it's going to be sustained throughout our lifetime in terms of physical activity. I think there are lots of reasons that kids don't play in the same way that they used to. Part is safety. I think parents are more reticent to let their kids go out in neighborhoods unsupervised. So we tend to get more into supervised sports and supervised activities, and kids get more and more scheduled. So I think it does take some of the self-initiation out of play. But I think, you know, there are great parks, and sometimes I look around and I look at parks, and the parks are empty. And I'm surprised that kids aren't playing in the parks.
Well, parents are afraid to let their kids go to the park.
Well, or even parents going to the parks or sharing or neighborhoods going to the park together, you know, and having parents go at different points in times. But I think that's certainly part of it. But I do think that has changed the schedule of the way families work, for sure.
Well, and if your kid wants to go to the park, but he wants to go with some friends, all the other kids are in organized sports. So he has no one to go with. Louise,
yeah,
go ahead, jump in.
No, that's a fantastic point. I was doing a talk in for the Seacoast Waldorf School in right up by you guys in early April, and one mother asked, you know, so there's nobody there, and they've set up, like, they have a pool in the backyard, and they've set up a treehouse, but this the neighborhood is destitute. There's not a child around. It's really, I mean, I'm laughing about this, but it's really sad. It's odd even. But the interesting thing about this caller, her comment about free play is brilliant on so many levels. Psychologists from the 60s on have been telling us that the way for a kid to become self-directed, self-confident, have adaptability, have creativity, learn how to socialize, become emotionally and psychologically prepared to handle social situations is through free play. Not being barked at the age of 5 or 7 on a team, but fooling around with friends. It doesn't have to be on a court. It can be in a backyard. And one of the things that we do at Whole Child Sports is recommend that your child start travel a lot later, that they don't start at 5 or 6 or 7, that they start at 11 or 12. And the key is what Heather said. Children are not socially, emotionally, neurologically, or physically ready to handle the rigors in all those four aspects that they will face in travel soccer. They need to play. When kids make up a game, the other day I was talking to my son. There were only four mitts. There was no bat. So what did the nine kids who wanted to play do? They invented a game, which worked. There was no home plate. There was a bunch of things that there was no first base. So they could have a fun game. They just invented it.
Okay, and here's the point, though, Luis. You know, you say there were nine kids, and lucky you, because in a lot of neighborhoods, there aren't nine kids. They're all in aftercare. They're all in organized sports. They're all at, you know, this, that, and the other thing. So, you know, pity the poor kid who would love to make up a game with nine other kids, but there aren't nine other kids.
To such a degree, and we address this in the chapter, The Power of Play and Beyond Winning, that a gentleman by the name of Mike Lanza was moved to write a book called Playborhood, which teaches neighborhood parents to create a funky, fun play space so that we can recapture what everybody's nostalgic for, which is the healthy atmosphere in which we fooled around, climbed trees, interacted with others. It's funny. We're looking at $1 billion a year now being spent in the emergency room visits of 1.35 children who are getting injured in adult-directed sports, sprains, fractures, concussions, abrasions, whatever it be. And this great quote from Psychology Today, children are highly motivated to play in risky ways, but they are also very good at knowing their own capacities and avoiding risks they are not ready to take, either physically or emotionally. Our children know far better than we do what they're ready for. When adults pressure or even encourage kids to take risks they aren't ready for, the end result may be trauma, not thrill. Ironic fact is that children are far more likely to injure themselves in adult directed sports and in their own free chosen self-directed
play. Just doing what they want to do in the backyard. Let me share another email with all of you. This is from Melissa in Hollis. She says, another downfall of starting kids so early in sports, to key into what your speakers have already said, is that some kids, boys especially, may not be at their most coordinated in their early years. So these super intense parents and coaches set the mindset for the kid that they are not athletic, when in truth, they may just not have matured. In previous generations, kids played intramural sports at younger ages, didn't start competitive sports until high school, when presumably they would be at their peak strength and ability. Pat, what do you think? This is a terrific point. A 6-year-old, an 8-year-old, a 10-year-old may decide, I'm no good because he can't catch the ball or whatever, when in fact, maybe by the time he's 11 or 12, he's terrific.
Yeah, I mean, that's a serious concern, and obviously I think the point's been made many times that we start too early, and there's no question about that. I think back in my day, which was a long time ago, when you would play as kids playing with other kids, you came up with a way to address that. Okay, you may have put Pat out in the left field or right field because I couldn't catch and there's never any balls going out there, but you embraced me and you got me engaged. So I was playing anyways. And I think young people are very much more adept at figuring those things out and not, you know, not putting that kind of pressure and on other students and they understand the difference in kids. I mean, that's what makes coaches so good and so good models, such good models for teaching. You know, they wouldn't take somebody like me and have me running the 100-yard dash. Okay, but, you know, I'm going to be a lineman, so I know that's my lot in life, but okay, and that's fine, but a good coach would find a way to do that, and they would never put everybody in the same position or expect the same from everybody because there are differences, and particularly at that level, maturational differences. So it's a great point that the caller made.
Thank you for that comment, and let's take one more. This is Julie in Hampton. Hi, Julie. Thanks for hanging on. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
Good. I actually heard Luis speak in April at the Seacoast Waldorf School, and he was absolutely terrific and made so many great points. My daughter goes to school there and has been for a few years. And the reason we send her there is just because our philosophy as parents, and it's weird because my husband works in Boston at one of the big tech companies, and he values technology, but we're just pushing our kids too much too soon with media, with academics, with these sports, and we're just expecting them to be little adults. And the work of childhood is to play. It's to open the front door when they get home from school and let them run out and let them climb a tree and let them play with their friends and go dig up worms in the yard. It's not to sit inside and have worksheet after worksheet and all that. It's to go out and to build intelligence, to build creativity through cooperation, through sharing, through playing ball together. And that's where they're going to become innovators, is when they're playing freely and they're playing with their hearts and they're playing because they're little kids. I mean, that's what we did when we were little kids. We climbed trees and our mother called us when it was dark. And I think that you can supervise your children by sitting on the front step and having a glass of lemonade and watching them play. You know, it doesn't have to be putting them in a gated area and watching them get yelled at by coaches.
Right. Julie, I'm going to cut you off there. Thank you so much for calling in. This is a point that was brought up earlier, but Heather, I'd love your thoughts.
I think as much as we can provide open play early on, that's important. There are opportunities for kids to become more competitive. I think parents do want to support their children. We just have to help them support their parents best. I guess I'd end on the note that when Division I college athletes were interviewed about what they would love their parents to say at the end of a game, there were six words: I love to watch you play. It wasn't, what were you thinking about when you went right and you should have gone left, or why didn't you? It was, I love to watch you play.
Yeah.
Six very simple words that encourage kids at all levels to keep playing.
All right. Well, thank you all very much for coming in. I really appreciate it. Good to see you, Pat Corbin. Thank you.
Nice to be here.
Pat Corbin, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Interscholastic Athletic Association. Luis Fernando Llosa, thank you very much for being here as well. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you. And it was great to be with Pat and Heather.
Luis is co-founder of Whole Child Sports. And Heather Barber, good to see you too.
Oh, thanks for having us. This was great.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, religious freedom back in the news. Two recent U.S. Supreme Court cases and a plethora of state legislative debates have once again raised questions about what we mean by religious freedom. From whether contraception coverage should be mandated, to prayer in public meetings, to private businesses objecting to serving same-sex couples. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange. Tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show, next at 10 o'clock on New Hampshire Public Radio, where we get support from you, our listeners. And support also comes to us from Heritage Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, Electric, Tune-Ups, Repairs, and Efficient Air Conditioning Systems, including ductless AC for homes without ductwork. Online at justcallheritage.com. And the law firm of Donahue Tucker and Chandela, offering legal representation to New Hampshire businesses, individuals, and municipalities. Online at dtclawyers.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. For the first time since the 2008 financial crisis, the government is set to make it easier to get mortgages. Too much loose credit contributed to the financial crisis, and in the aftermath, rules were tightened. Now there's a concern that those tougher standards are stifling